You're listening to the Play Therapy Podcast with Dr. Brenna Hicks, your source for centered and focused play therapy coaching.
Hi, I'm Dr. Brenna Hicks, and this is the Play Therapy Podcast. In today's episode, this is number 3 of a 6-part series that was recorded at the Florida Association for Play Therapy Conference that we just did last weekend. So there are 6 parts from the 3-hour talk. This is the 3rd section. And in today's episode, we are talking through the foundations of play therapy, a continuation of last episode, but specifically the core beliefs of child-centered play therapy. If you'd like to follow along, please visit playtherapypodcast.com/FAPT, as in Florida Association for Play Therapy, so that you can see the overview and also have all of the slides from the talk. I hope you enjoy. So, core beliefs. Never do for a child that which he can do for himself. Straight out of CPRT. Okay, so the premise here is just like kids have no control, they also are not given opportunities to develop responsibility. So, can a child get something down off of the shelf even though it's too high? Yes. Can a child figure out how to use that Nerf gun that they don't know how to cock so that it will shoot? Yes. But what happens in every other arena, in every other world of the child? What is this for? Oh, you just do this and you blah, 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 blah. Or I can't reach that. Oh, let me get it for you. Never do for a child that which he can do for himself. Why? Because it creates problem solving, it creates resilience, creates resourcefulness, it creates the ability to figure out what to do to believe in themselves. Learned helplessness is the death of future generations. Have you heard the term snowflake generation? They're so fragile they can't handle anything. Why? Because everyone does everything for everybody these days. So what do we have to do? I'm sure you can figure it out. You'll be able to do that. You know what to do. There's something in here that could help you get that. And you sit and you wait, which the control freaks can't stand it, y'all, right? So you've got to be super patient. You've got to trust the process. You've got to wait sometimes weeks on end. But the day that a kid goes, I know how to do that, and they do it, how much more meaningful is that for the child's self-worth, self-identity, self-esteem, self-confidence, when they have worked and worked and it's been bugging them and they've been ruminating on it for weeks at a time and they get it, versus, I don't know how to do this. Oh, you just pull it back. Here you go. What does that communicate? You're incompetent and I am competent. When a child struggles, I didn't give up and I got it. I feel that I am worth something. It's a total paradigm shift. So never do for a child that which he can do for himself. Really, really important piece in the playroom, because kids, especially with learned helplessness, especially with high levels of anxiety, they are used to people swooping in and solving things for them. So we have to be pretty strong in our approach that says, you can do that. You can do hard things. It's so hard. Ms. Brenna, I can't. Oh, you're disappointed, but you can do it. Why? Because the message is, I believe in you. I don't need to help you. You can do this. And when they prove that to themselves, what does that do internally? Internal locus of control, internal motivation. I'm not waiting for you. I'm going to take care of it. Problem solving in their lives, resilience, coping, all these things long term. Not even in the play therapy process. It's amazing enough to watch it happen in the playroom. Think about at 30 years old. When a child gets this because a therapist cared enough to say, I'm not going to do it for you. What does that do long term for their marriage, for their parenting, for their career, for everything in their life? I believe in myself. I can do it. It's incredibly powerful. Okay, another core belief. When there are no limits, there is no security. So here is our argument for, so you just let my kid do whatever the heck they want in your playroom? No, I don't, I promise you. When there are no limits, there is no security. So we set limits when necessary and when needed. Not until then. I've had many, many kids tell their mom or dad or whomever, do you know there's only one rule in the playroom? It's that I can't climb. If I climb on her shelves, I have to sit on my bottom when I get to the top. Why does that kid think that's the only limit in my playroom? Because that's the only limit I've ever need to set with him. If he chucked Hot Wheels at my face, he would say, the only rule in Miss Brenna's playroom is that I'm not allowed to throw Hot Wheels at her head. Because limits are set when they're necessary and when they're needed. But otherwise, we give them complete freedom. So every kid has a different understanding of what the limits are, because I only set limits for that child's behavior in that moment. So the security that is found in saying, and here's why and when we set limits. This is freebie, it's not part of this, but you need to know it. So limits are serve really three purposes. I have to be safe. So the therapist always needs to be safe. The child always needs to be safe. And the toys are not for breaking on purpose. So beyond those three things, there are no rules in a playroom. So when the child's doing something that's endangering me, I will set a limit. Endangering themselves, I will set a limit. Snapping my arrows over their legs, I will set a limit. But otherwise, they're not needed. But when limits are set, it communicates to the child, I'm secure. Because they need the control, they need the power, but it has to be balanced with limits for security. Because even though they act as if they want and need full rein to do whatever they want, they desperately need boundaries. But they need them set in a way that respects the child-centered model, which is I unconditionally accept you, I give you the freedom that you need, and I'm only going to set a limit when I have to. Does that make sense? So we do set limits for security within the relationship and to help them learn to self-regulate. They have to know how to practice controlling their behavior. So, and we're actually, when we get to the pillars, I'm going to show you step by step of how to set limits. So hold that thought, I promise. Okay, just noticing children is a powerful builder of self-esteem. We cannot undervalue or underestimate what it does for a child to have someone really pay attention to them. And it goes back to relationship, right? But we basically, in the playroom for that 50 minutes a week, they are our one and only world. And we notice what they say, what they don't say, how they act, the themes that they play, what they say to us, how they communicate. We notice them. And it builds self-esteem. And if I had to, oh, I'm actually going to give you two things here. If I had to say what is the most common issue that kids come to the playroom for, it is almost always tied to self-esteem in some way, shape, or form. So that's at the root of the bulk of problems, first of all. And second of all, self-esteem is one of the quickest fixes in a playroom. So they all come in needing self-esteem and they all leave with loads of it. So that's a really, really important piece, is that we notice them. We pay attention, we put all of our attention and time into that relationship for that hour each week. All right, feelings are always valid, even when behavior is not acceptable. Because when we, I'm actually just gonna tell you a story, that's always better. So I had a mom in the lobby who watched her son pull the door over the top of his toes. And he had taken his shoes off, which she doesn't like when he does it. So there's the backstory. He had already broken a rule and she didn't want him to take his shoes off. He has his shoes off. He drags the door over the top of his toes and like scrapes skin, bleeding. He might have even broken a nail. I don't know. And he's a little guy. And he's crying really, really, really hard. And my response is, that hurt. You're really upset. That hurts so much. And she's like, see, this is why I tell you not to take your shoes off. And I don't understand why you won't listen to me. And I'm watching this unfold. And I'm thinking, the behavior wasn't okay. You asked him to keep his shoes on and he disobeyed. But his feelings in that moment were extremely valuable. And he didn't feel heard or understood at all, because the focus was on the behavior rather than the feeling. So in the playroom, child-centered model says, your feelings are always important, and I will always validate, always acknowledge, always communicate that I'm trying to get it. Do I sometimes have to set a limit on behavior? Yes. I made the mistake, never again, but I made the mistake of having fake plastic shotgun shell cartridges. It came with like a rifle set, and if you put it in and then you cocked it, it like popped the cartridge out like you had just shot a bullet. Really cool in concept, except that there were these 2-inch long hard plastic cartridges that kids very quickly learned they could put into my crossbow, which shoots really fast, and shoot at me. So those disappeared really quickly out of the playroom. But this one kid who power and control struggled with me for weeks on end, every week would load them and I would say, I know you want to shoot those, but I'm not for shooting. I mean, before I could blink, they're firing at me. One actually hit me right here once and left like a circular mark ring on me. It hit me so hard. And then the next week when he came in, he was like, where are those things? And I was like, oh, you noticed those aren't here. You took them out just because you knew I was coming, didn't you? I'm like, oh, you think that you're the reason I don't have them in here. Anyway, that's another story, but do you notice that I never answer questions? But we'll get to that later. Anyway, so feelings are always valid. I was like, you really want to shoot me with those. You really like trying to hurt me. You think it's fun when it hits me and leaves a mark. I'm validating, like, you're angry, you're mad, you don't want to be here, you don't like me, you don't like play therapy, you don't like your parents for bringing you here, you don't like anything about this. I get it, but I'm not for shooting. And if you choose to shoot me, you choose for me to get rid of the shotgun shells that you're shooting me with, right? So we do have to accept the feelings even when the behavior needs to be addressed. All right, one of my absolute favorites, back to Charlie Schaefer. If you know enough to ask a question, you know enough to make a statement. Here's what we do. Did that scare you? When a kid goes, we go, oh my gosh, did that scare you? You know that the child is scared. You already identified what the child was feeling. So we never ever have to ask a question, because we can always turn it into a statement. We're going to talk about reflecting feelings in the pillars, so I will show you what that process looks like. But when we're talking about core beliefs, we always are able to make statements. Because what happens when we ask a kid a question? Where do they have to go to answer the question? But that's not where they are. They're down here. So to let them live in their hearts, we make statements, acknowledging their feelings without asking questions. Oh, do you want to do that? Oh, do you want to play that game now? Oh, are we going to go do that? Oh, we ask questions all day long, and we've been conditioned to do so. We think, because the English language says, if you want information, you do what? You ask questions. Who, what, when, where, how, why, right? We learned it in like second grade. We need questions answered. We ask questions. The incredible contradiction of that for child-centered is you already know. You don't need to ask. You already know. They've already shown you. They've told you. They've expressed it. They've given you eye contact. They've given you a nonverbal cue. There's something there already. So you say it in a statement instead. Now, I'm gonna help you out. I'm gonna give you the disclaimer. You're going to start doing this. You're going to catch yourself asking questions, and you're going to go, no, I'm not supposed to ask a question. I can make a statement. So then you're going to go, that scared you? Which is technically a statement. If you're grammatically writing that, it deserves a period, right? That scared you, period. But when we go, scared you? We turn it into a question in context. So that's going to be your transition. You're going to go, okay, I'm not supposed to ask questions. I'm going to make statements. So that's step one, catching yourself, changing it. But you will turn statements into questions at the beginning because we're so used to wanting the response, right? Because it's really hard to go, that scared you, and get nothing from the kid. Because then it's like, well, maybe they weren't scared. They didn't say, yeah, they didn't answer me. Like, are they really scared? I don't know. But you're going to eventually go, that scared you. And whether they verbally acknowledge you or not, you know that it scared them because of what they showed you when they went, oh, okay. So you will train yourself to go down at the end of your sentences. In the beginning, you will still go up, but that is part of the learning curve of changing your questions into statements. It's really incredible what happens when we make statements to kids because it keeps them in their feelings, which is where they're meant to be. And it's where they live. Okay, next core belief. In play, children express what their lives are like, what they need, or how they wish things were. So, when we're in a play session, they are always telling us one, two, or three of these things. So, what their lives are like, they'll play out any given scenario in their world. That tells us what their lives are like. I had a kid very first week. You're going to be the mom. Hands me the mom doll. I'm going to be the kid. Takes the kid doll. Says, okay, be the mom. Now, in a lot of other models, I see you moving around me. In any other model, I would say, okay, you're gonna come with me. I would just start narrating, right? You told me to be the mom, I'm gonna be the mom. I said nothing because the child-centered model doesn't lead, and I waited. I got no prompt, so I said, I wonder what the mom does. We're gonna get to I wonder statements, so hold on. But I wonder what the mom does. Get in your room right now! And he starts just railing. You're in trouble, get in your room, you're grounded. Would I have chosen that's what the mom said? Hard no. But that was what the child's life was like. So in the first 5 minutes, I was like, wow, that's what your life is like. I didn't need to say, so it sounds like you and your mom don't get along based on our consultation. Let's talk about that. You're going to be the mom. Bah, bah, bah. Okay, well, that's what the child's life is like. That's usually where things start. Okay, you get a really good picture of what a child's life is like early on. Then it moves into what they need. What do they need? They don't need mom screaming. They don't need the conflict. They don't need the argument. So they'll start to show you what they need. They move into nurturing play. They move into caregiving play. They move into all these themes that say, this is what I need. And then eventually, how they wish things were. They role reverse, they rewrite their story, they change the script, they do something that says, this is how I wish things were. They become the mom, and the mom is really soothing and really gentle and really kind and really loving. And all of a sudden, they're making sense through their play of what their lives were like, what they need, and how they wish things were. So if we get those three things, we look through the lens of that with what's going on in the playroom, gives us a whole big picture and insight of what's going on. When a child is drowning, it is not the time to teach them to swim. So adults are notorious for trying to teach a lesson at the worst time. And in a child-centered model, we say, your emotions are so big right now, it's not the time for you to be taught anything because you can't be up here anyway. You have to cognitively process something if you're going to learn something. And when a child is emotionally overwhelmed, when the emotions have escalated so high, there's no way that they can process anything. So that's not the time to try to teach them. So in the playroom, when they are clawing to get out and they're saying, I want to go see my mom, or they fell and hurt themselves and they're rocking back and forth, losing their mind, when I didn't get the game down for them and they start throwing things at me, that's not the time to teach them to swim. because they can't receive it anyway. So I've been told that because I grew up the daughter of an air conditioning business owner, that not everyone knows what a float switch is. So I'll explain the float switch before I tell you this story. So a float switch serves as a threshold within pumps, usually. So pool pumps, air conditioner pumps. So liquid rises to a certain level, it flips the switch. That's a float switch. So it gets to a certain point, it flips, something happens, then if the liquid comes back down, it flips again. So now you know what a float switch is. Thank my dad. So I always liken emotions in a child to a pot with a float switch. So emotions rise. They hit a certain threshold, the float switch gets tripped. It actually says to the brain, go ahead and take a nap. You're out of the picture, you're done, you're on a siesta, see you in a little while. Emotions flood, do whatever the emotions need to do. Then the emotions start to de-escalate, float switch gets tripped once again, brain comes back in, and then the brain says, what in the world did you do that for? Why did you just freak out? You know better. You shouldn't have said that. You shouldn't have thrown that. You shouldn't have acted that way. But, and then when you say, why did you do that? What's the answer?
I don't know.
I don't know. And parents go, they always say, they don't. And I'm like, they're telling the truth. And they're like, what? What do you mean? I'm like, they don't know. They didn't think at all. Their brain was sleeping. Their feeling was just saying, feel, express, this is what's going on. And then the brain comes back in and goes, whoa, hang on, right? So the play therapy process says, we're gonna bridge. We're gonna bridge the gap. It's called development of worldview. So my emotions can't always override everything. But until that happens, when the emotions are overriding everything, they can't learn. That's not the moment for them to receive anything. So you have to be sensitive in the playroom when those emotions are that high. You just meet them in their feeling, and that's enough. We'll talk about that a little bit more when we get into reflecting feelings. Okay, this is probably the biggest. We always, always focus on the relationship and never the problem. Because what do parents, caregivers, loved ones, whoever brings children to us, what do they say from the very first moment they walk in the door? Fix my kid. This is the problem. You're my last hope. Fix my kid. And I always say, I don't fix kids. They're not broken. And I'm going to focus on your child, not the problem. Because out of the relationship, everything fixes itself. It's a total paradigm shift, y'all. Like, if this is rocking your world, this is what child-centered does. Every night in my graduate certificate program, every night, it was a Tuesday night class, 5 to 9, I lived an hour away from USF. So from 9 to 10, every night in the dark, I'm driving home and I'm calling him every night driving home over the bridge. Oh my gosh, you focus on the relationship. You don't even care what's going on with the kid. I mean, every night for weeks and weeks on end, I was like, how have I never known how much I need to know this? How did I live my whole life not getting this, not understanding this? Because the problem is not the focus. When we focus on the problem, it's our agenda. It's, I'm going to fix you. I'm going to make this better. I'm going to make your parents feel better. I'm going to make them glad they spent this money. And the implication is there's something wrong with you. The relationship says, I unconditionally accept you no matter what. And when they feel that way, everything fixes. Because I have my person, right? Every week I go with this person, they just love me. When I'm at my worst, when I'm absolutely terrible, when they should punish me, when they should hate me, how many times have we had a kid that goes, all right, what's the line? What do I need to do to get you to say you never are going to come here again? I'm going to do everything in my power so that they say you're not allowed to come here anymore. Why? Because that's what they've known their whole lives. You push me far enough, you're done. And when I go, you're saying every hateful thing that you can think of. And then they just look at you like, and? There's no and. I accept you. Hate me. We're good. And what happens? Gosh, I hate the feeling. I know how wrong it is that I'm being so mean to her. I hate that feeling. I'm not going to do that anymore. Self-control. Y'all, it's revolutionary. Like, you dive into child-centered and you use this and this becomes your model, everything is different. Everything.
Thank you for listening to the Play Therapy Podcast with Dr. Brenna Hicks. For more episodes and resources, please go to www.playtherapypodcast.com.